Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
He turned to me and stroked the ruby necklace that bit into my neck, but with such tenderness now that I ceased flinching, and he caressed my breasts. "My dear one, my little love, my child, did it hurt her? He's so sorry for it, such impetuousness. He could not help himself. You see, he loves her so." And this lover's recitative of his brought my tears in a flood. I clung to him as though only the one who had inflicted the pain could comfort me for suffering it. For a while, he murmured to me in a voice I'd never heard before, a voice like the soft consolations of the sea. But then he unwound the tendrils of my hair from the buttons of his smoking jacket, kissed my cheek briskly, and told me the agent from New York had called with such urgent business that he must leave as soon as the tide was low enough. Leave the castle? Leave France? And would be away for at least 6 weeks. But it's our honeymoon.
Today we're opening the door on the second half of Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber.
It is her 1979 retelling of Bluebeard. In a 1985 interview, she was quoted as saying, "My intention was not to do versions, or as the American edition of the book said horribly, adult fairy tales, but to extract the latent content from the traditional stories." It is that humanizing of the story, that realistic interior monologue of the main character, that subverts the folktale and makes it strange, which is why we're covering it here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Leike. We are joined today by reader Michelle Sawyer, a Madison actor and writer, and so glad to have her on the show.
Yeah, thank you, Michelle. It's been a week since the last episode, and I'm a little foggy about what we discussed last time, among other things.
Well, we didn't get too far into the story last week because we got caught up in the whirlwind of the amazing life of Angela Carter, as well as the Bluebeard myth.
I did find myself this week browsing her other books, which doesn't always happen with our authors when we do a story, but the writing in this just has definitely made me a fan. I wasn't sure when I grabbed the book about that, because retelling a folk or a fairy tale from a different point of view, it doesn't seem that original. It's almost its own genre at this point.
Sure.
Like that movie Maleficent. You know, I don't want to go see that because it looks way too scary. But I did recently read Snow Glass Apples, which is Neil Gaiman's retelling of Snow White.
Oh.
From the stepmother's perspective. It's a story he wrote in the 90s, but it was recently adapted by Dark Horse as a graphic novel with Colleen Doran as the artist.
Oh, right.
Really beautiful book. But if it wasn't for the art, I'm not sure I would have read it just from the TV guide description.
Sure.
It wasn't until I dug into the story that I realized what makes it so special is the actual storytelling.
Right.
She's an excellent writer. So let's get into the storytelling.
Our story so far is about an unnamed 17-year-old who has married a French marquis. She is from a poor family with only her mother, who was a super pirate-finding badass in her youth, to take care of her before her marriage. The Marquis is extremely wealthy and has just taken her virginity in the bed that he was born and most likely conceived in.
It just goes to show that even if you're rich, you can still recycle.
Oh, God. Now, she is a talented pianist, but not very self-confident. The Marquis is making her feel sexy and sexual, and she seems to be into this awakening. However, she's super annoyed that after the first time around, he's off to America for 6 weeks to leave her right after they did the deed only once.
He separated her from her family, placed her in this castle that is literally cut off from the rest of the world every day when the tide comes in. And now he's leaving her to her own devices, or rather to his devices. It's just like when you're crashing with somebody and they have to go to work. They leave you in their house. Except he doesn't even explain to her how the four remote controls work. She's going to have to figure that out on her own.
Now, she complains about this, and he just dresses her down, calls her a silly little girl who doesn't understand the ways of the world. And he tells her that he can have dinner with her, and then he's got to go. She agrees, because she doesn't really have much of a choice. Now, at dinner, he gives her a bunch of keys, and they're full-on Scooby-Doo keys.
Something that, like, a prison guard would have lazily attached to his belt.
A prison guard in the Old West.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He tells her that she's in charge now, and he trusts her to have the run of the castle. All except for one key to one room. The Marquis says that every man must have at least one secret from his wife. Now, he asks her to promise him that she will never go in this room. She can have anything and everything everywhere else in the castle, but that room is his secret special room, his man cave, where he can enjoy his home theater, his stand-up Galaga machine. and his Batman action figures.
I like that in Chris Lackey's retelling of Bluebeard, everything turns on Galaga. I have a secret room that you must never enter. Yeah, that's fine. I got plenty to do. There is a Galaga in there. What? He actually doesn't tell her what is in the room at all.
Nope.
Just that it's where he goes sometimes to forget that he has a wife. Mm. He says the key to the room is not the key to his heart, but the key to his enfer. E-N-F-E-R, which I had to look up. Mm-hmm. It's a French word for hell.
Oh, wow.
It does sound like you're saying on fire with a French accent. As a way to
fire.
Remember. Enfer.
On fire.
But he calls it his hell. Even more tempting.
Now she agrees, and he's off after dinner. She watches the car drive away from the castle. Now, this narrator, she's at a loss. She's not sure how to feel about all of this. And her new husband, she longs for him, yet he disgusts her.
It's some of that psychological accuracy you typically wouldn't find in a folktale that comes across in the way that she tells it. Mm-hmm. The narrator is a young person who's just had sex for the first time. There's so much pressure on that moment in your life leading up to it. Oftentimes, after that first sexual experience, if it's positive, it's like, okay, that's done now. Let's get good at this. Mm. You know, you've made the team. It's time for spring training.
Yeah.
It's a nice period of time in a couple's life. But for her, it was just the one time, and then he's off,
yeah.
Leaving her to just kind of think about it.
Yeah. And she's more rich than she could have ever dreamed. But is it worth it to be trapped in this castle alone?
I have a memory of being at this dance club in Las Vegas, and the dance floor was crowded. Everybody's having a pretty good time, but you could see this area with a velvet rope up on some stairs. Mm-hmm. It was like the VIP area, and there were like three people up there looking at their phones, so lonely. It's like getting that VIP access is great, but what's the point if you're cut off from civilization,
yeah, know.
You know?
It's lame.
The only value, I suppose, in her situation is a home alone kind of thing, or maybe it's more of a shining thing, that nobody is around to modulate her behavior. She's got the run of this whole castle, which is full of riches and things to look at. So, you know, you can ride your big wheel anywhere you want. There's one night of fun in that.
Yeah. So the next day she practices playing the piano for 3 hours, and then she calls in the piano tuner, who is a young, handsome, blind man.
When she played the piano the night before, it was all out of whack from the ocean air, but they're so rich that the Marquis can just hire a full-time, on-call, live-in piano tuner.
Yeah.
However, that means that there's a new staff member that he's not used to, somebody who might not be quite as allegiant as the others.
Mm. Now, he was a blacksmith's son, but was taught the art of tuning by a priest who helped him make a living. This guy is a bit of a charmer. He says he thought he would be happy here. And if, he added slyly, he might sometimes be allowed to hear me play, for you see, he loved music. Yes, of course, I said. Certainly. He seemed to know that I had smiled.
The guy is blind, so he doesn't like her for her looks, but for her talent,
yeah.
For what's within. He's also a blacksmith's son, which means he's fit. That's shorthand for he's fit, right?
Exactly.
Do I look good with my shirt off? I don't know. I feel with something that's like a washboard down here, but no idea what it looks like.
The narrator dismisses the piano tuner and takes a bath in a crazy huge ornate tub. It has gold dolphin taps, but still, she's lonely. She just wants to talk to somebody, but her station doesn't allow her to chat with the staff. So she calls her mom and has a good cry.
We don't hear the other end of the conversation, but we get that her mother's saying, why are you crying about gold bath taps? Why would that upset you?
Yeah. She says, nothing is wrong. I've got golden dolphin taps. What more could a human want? But the phone connection is so bad, she loses contact with her mom. So now she's got nothing to do, no one to talk to. What should she do? Oh, the keys. Perhaps I should explore this crazy mansion.
And she has keys to everything. Like you say, it's the big crazy ring. She can even get into his private office if she wants. He's so careless about it, he says, you can make origami out of my super valuable stock certificates. That's how little I care. Look through anything you want, he said. But darling, you must ignore the sounds of the Galaga.
The narrator finds an amazing library. She also finds lots of jewels, priceless items. She goes through his desk and looks at his finances and his business affairs. But she can't find anything saucy. Everything is in order, and it all seems on the up and up.
There's a almost Lovecraftian passage that's just about the art that he has in the house and lots of references to specific paintings that are real about women in distress. One of the paintings is by Gustave Moreau, I think.
Right,
so there's another technical relation to our previous story, The Island of Dr. Moreau.
I'll take the threads where I can get them.
Yep.
Now, the narrator, she does find some traces of his past marriages. She finds this very odd postcard of a village graveyard where a black-coated ghoul is digging a grave.
I had hoped it was an actual ghoul. Like, she just found the Call of Cthulhu source book in his library. But I think it's meant to be a gravedigger.
Yeah.
Dwight Fry kind of character. So maybe it's just a still from a Universal movie.
Could be. It says on the image, typical Transylvanian scene, midnight. And on the back, his ex-wife Camilla wrote, on the occasion of this marriage to the descendant of Dracula, always remember the supreme and unique pleasure of love is the certainty that one is doing evil. So, is this a joke? The narrator thinks about Camilla being very sophisticated and that maybe she doesn't quite get the joke because she's not as fancy as Camilla was.
And I didn't quite get it either. It's a little more sophisticated than me as well. I didn't quite understand what it meant. A little digging reveals this is a quote from Charles Baudelaire. The poet, the author of Fleur de Mal, Flowers of Evil, has come up on the show multiple times. The quote is, "The unique and supreme voluptuousness of love lies in the certainty of committing evil, and men and women know from birth that in evil is found all sensual delight." What do you think that means?
I think he's trying to say that all pleasure comes at the expense of something. Thereby is evil. I mean, that's what he's saying. I don't know if I agree with that.
Right, but that something has to be forbidden, I thought, maybe.
Oh, you think? Oh,
to bring pleasure. But what you're saying, I think, is probably closer to what Baudelaire meant, that it has to be evil. Evil means that somebody's suffering as a result.
Yeah.
It's a pretty whack point of view, I guess. Fleur de Mal is all about that kind of stuff, really transgressive thoughts.
Yes.
That's what's up with this. But I did think it led into the next section where what's she going to be interested in this castle where all the riches of the world are? What's the one thing that's the most interesting? And it's the forbidden thing.
Yes.
But you know, on hearing you read that caption on the photo this time, the typical Transylvanian scene, it says, on the occasion of this marriage to the descendant of Dracula, always remember the supreme blah, blah, blah. And I thought descendant of Dracula meant her, Carmilla.
Yeah.
But maybe it means him.
Oh.
Like she's saying, on the occasion of my marriage to the descendant of Dracula. Because was some stuff that's said in here that makes me think he's older than, I don't know. Well, let's keep going and I'll point it out when we come to it.
All right, right.
Just suddenly occurred to me.
Now, all of this stuff, like you said, is boring, but the forbidden key, that is not boring. That is interesting. She realizes, look, I'm going to do it. And she has no fear about it. This is her house. She can do what she wants.
Yeah, she realizes that the most delight is in doing what's forbidden.
She opens up the door to complete darkness, and the first thing that she finds is an Iron Maiden.
Yes.
Excellent! And I'm sure we've talked about this before, but the Iron Maiden was supposedly a medieval torture device, but was actually invented around the 1800s as something to scare people and was not actually used for torture.
I remember we brought that up on an episode and it was a revelation to me because I just assumed, you know, you think that, man, those torture machines were so bad and that's the first one you think of. Weirdly, that regularly comes up in conversation and not because I mentioned it. It seems like other people will say, oh, Iron Maidens, you know, those are fake. Like that's just, so I don't know if this was in some piece of really widely viewed television or film or something.
Maybe.
But it's like this worldwide realization happened about Iron Maidens just recently.
I was looking up some Iron Maiden stuff. There was something that people used occasionally where it was a wooden box that had nails in it and it was stood up and they were meant to stand in the middle of it so they couldn't sit down. So that's very similar to the Iron Maiden, but it was just a wooden box with nails in it. It wasn't anything fancy.
That's like an Ewok version of an Iron Maiden.
And there was also this thing which looked like a giant bucket that you would put your head through a hole in the bottom of the bucket and then it would clamp around your head and so you couldn't use your arms.
You say you would do that as if somebody walked up to it and did that on purpose. Someone's making you do that. That's right. Terrible.
Yeah. There's a few torture devices that were kind of like that, but nothing as ornate or as recognizable as the Iron Maiden.
Wow.
Now this room is full of torture stuff. It's basically a torture chamber. It has stone walls. Hopefully, she's thinking, oh, this is going to be his museum of perversity. So
yeah.
He's just in a kink.
It's his little haunted house. It's like a wax museum, maybe. No big deal, she's telling herself. It's kind of like my friend Dan. He has his own video game room. It's got some full-size stormtroopers in there.
Oh, wow.
Like the costumes on mannequins.
Right.
If you were an Ewok strolling in, it would be very shocking.
Oh, yeah.
But otherwise, you know, pretty cool. She hopes it's something like that.
Unfortunately, as she looks around more, she finds a large bed with candles around it. And as she lights them, she finds the body of the opera singer, his first wife. This body has been embalmed and it is preserved. The worst thing was the dead lips smiled.
And there are lilies everywhere here, as well as there were in her bedchamber. the funereal flower. That imagery of lilies is wound throughout the story. This actress has been strangled and laid out in a very theatrical tableau, preserved so that she wouldn't rot. So there's an element of the punishment fits the career or something.
All right, yeah. Now, she finds also a polished skull suspended in the air wearing a white veil, and this, she assumes, is the second wife.
Because the second wife was like a legendary beauty, an artist's model, and everybody knows her face. So the face was erased, but even her skull is beautiful. She recognizes the woman because even her skull is devastatingly beautiful.
And where's the third? The Romanian woman, the Iron Maiden.
With trembling fingers, I pried open the front of the upright coffin with its sculpted face caught in a rictus of pain. Then, overcome, I dropped the key I still held in my other hand. It dropped into the foaming pool of her blood. She was pierced, not by one, but by 100 spikes, this child of the land of the vampires who seemed so newly dead, so full of blood. Oh God, how recently had he become a widower? How long had he kept her in this obscene cell? Had it been all the time he had courted me in the clear light of Paris? I closed the lid of her coffin very gently and burst into a tumult of sobbing that contained both pity for his other victims and also a dreadful anguish to know I, too, was one of them.
So this is Carmilla, the Romanian countess. She seems newly dead, full of blood.
Yeah.
So I wondered, is she really dead? Or is she a vampire that's been basically entombed in a box of stakes, that would hold her immobile? They said she disappeared in a boating accident and he remarried pretty fast, but not fast enough for her to be in this shape.
No.
So either he kept her captive and just killed her for effect, which is possible, or she is a Dracula.
Yeah. Because if she's got fresh blood, if there's liquid blood, then that, I mean, she's got to be recently, really recently dead.
Right.
Because that stuff coagulates fast.
Right. Or she's just in a state halfway between because the stakes can hold her but not kill her.
I like this vampire idea. I'm going to believe it's true.
Right.
Now, the narrator, she doesn't freeze. Quite the opposite. She quickly realizes that she's on the clock and she's got to hide every trace of being here. So she picks up the key with a hanky and attempts to set everything as it was before.
She puts Carmilla back in the box with the stakes. I kind of hope that if she left her out, could have been a vampire third act, you know?
Oh, yeah. Way to ruin it. The narrator doesn't feel safe in the bedroom because it obviously makes her think of the Marquis. So she goes to the music room. And there she wonders if the help know, the staff. But with their loyalties to the family, she thinks that they must. Or if they didn't, they would still side with the Marquis.
Same with the local police. If she runs away and tells the townspeople or the local police, they're just not going to believe her. He's the richest guy in France.
Yeah. But that always frightens me. It's just the power of the rich person, you know, like
right.
The idea that he could just go to the chief of police or whatever and just go, I'll give you $1 million if you just let this thing go.
And you don't even have to commit a crime. Just, forget something.
Yeah.
Don't interview this person.
I'd like to think that the police would be good people and wouldn't accept a bribe like that. But when it comes to $1 million, that's insane. You know, like that's life-changing money.
Yeah. And you're probably guilty of something.
Oh, sure.
I mean, that's the way I thought it through when I was a policeman. And... No, but if you can imagine somebody bribing you and that you might be tempted, then why would you not think that anybody else would be as well?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Now, the narrator tries to call her mother for help, but the lion is dead. So she plays the piano, her only escape. But then she hears something and the clatter of her husband's cane. He's back. Oh, no. But to her surprise, it's not the Marquis she hears, but it's the piano tuner. And he says that he heard her playing in the night and he couldn't sleep himself. The tuner apologizes for stepping out of his station, but he thought that she might want some company. And he found the keys to the house just lying around, missing the bloody key, of course. Obviously, she has that. The narrator takes the keys back and the tuner can't help but gush about how amazing a player she is. And she tells him how perfectly tuned the piano is. It's a compliment off between the two. Is it love?
I think so.
The narrator sees him there, and he's so sweet and kind, and it makes her think of the horrors of the bloody chamber, and then she just faints. only to find yourself awakening in the piano tuner's arms. He's confused at why she's so upset. She's a new bride. She should be totally happy. But then he sees the bloody key and she decides to tell him everything.
That's the cover of the book right there, right? She's passed out or wake, coming to in the piano tuner's arms, the bloody key just falling out of her hand.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, the piano tuner tells her that there are legends about the Marquis and his family in the region. How there was a Marquis who would hunt young girls like they were foxes, and how another murdered a blacksmith's wife and then just casually showed him her decapitated head.
Yeah.
The piano tuner, of course, he thought these were just myths, but now he's not so sure.
I wondered if these were references to Gilles de Rais, the child murderer from the 1400s that you mentioned on the last episode. Mm-hmm. I also, this is the part where I wondered, is this really a long line of heartless murderers? Or is this the same Marquis who's passing himself off century after century as his own family?
Yeah,
his own descendants. Typical Dracula move.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm thinking, yes, he's a vampire too. There are two Draculas in this
story. I love it. So much Draculas going on. So just then, the car is pulling up to the castle. This time it is actually the Marquis. He's really back.
Yeah, right now the passage to the castle is open. The tide is out. His car will pass through. But I love that element of time. It will close up again soon and they will be cut off.
She tries to wash off the key, but it's stained with this blood. No matter how hard she scrubs it, it's just not coming off. Piano tuner says, look, I'll stay with you. But she orders him to leave because he's like, you're not going to be able to do anything.
And she's going to try and handle this with an old tactic called lying. She's just going to say, huh? I didn't go in there.
So the Marquis finally arrives. He kisses his new wife. He says that the deal fell through and he doesn't have to go to New York. He can be with her. And he tries to get sexy with her, but he can see that she's a bit freaked out. This doesn't turn him off. It actually kind of inflames his passions. The Marquis begins to disrobe, pulling things out of his pockets. But then he looks as if he's lost something. And he goes, oh, yes, I gave you my keys. You know, putting on the show.
Yeah.
And she says, well, I'll get them later. And he says, no. I want them now.
He orders her to get them. He doesn't go grab them himself.
Yes.
When you come at the story with more psychological realism, you also kind of see the Marquis's behavior in this compulsive serial killer light. Mm. You know, he has to have these things done in a certain order. It's not the sex or the killing that he's really after. It's the disappointment and the punishment.
Yeah.
It's a Garden of Eden fantasy, which is alluded to even in the text. Eve has to eat the apple so that he can punish her.
Right.
And those rules have to be in place. And he's done this a few times. One might think he's even getting a little sloppy at this point.
Now, she gets the keys, including the one with the bloody mark. And when the narrator returns, she says that the Marquis seemed to be in despair.
The face that turned towards me contained a somber delirium that seemed to me compounded of a ghastly, yes, shame, but also of a terrible guilty joy as he slowly ascertained how I had sinned.
I think it's kind of interesting because it's not, he's just not an evil villain. You know, there's some other things going on with him. Like, he does feel a bit sad and tired out by this whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. He goes to the Galaga machine hoping that he won't see her name on the high scores. And there it is again. It always gives them away.
She can see now that the blood mark on the key actually looks like a heart from a playing card. So a very stylized, almost like an icon of a heart.
Right.
And he says, oh, my love, my little love, who brought me a white gift of music, he said, as almost grieving. My little love, you'll never know how much I hate daylight. You know, he commands her to kneel and prepare for martyrdom. So he takes the key, places it on her forehead. The mark leaves the key and goes to the middle of her forehead, just above her eyes.
It's her mark of shame. And of course, that reminds me of Dracula once again, because Mina had a carnal encounter with the Count, and even though she was unwilling, she has to bear that mark of shame, which is also a heavy theme, obviously, in that high school favorite, The Scarlet Letter.
Sure.
The kids love that one.
Yeah.
They don't.
They do.
This whole situation, though, also does a recent story that we covered, The Trains.
Oh, right.
That seems like it might have been a bit of a Bluebeard story. We never found out what was going on those other levels of the house.
Right. Yes.
You imagine
yeah.
It might have been something like this.
Well, and also this mark makes me think of the mark of Cain, which is something in the Bible. Because Cain slayed his brother and he was marked by God. And what that mark is never really explained. Is it a mark on your soul? Is it a physical mark? You know, whatever.
Clearly, it's an iconography that has to be in this little play that he puts on over and over.
Mm-hmm. He declares that she is to be decapitated. And he tells her to bathe and put on that sexy dress from when they saw Tristan and that ruby choker. When she's ready, she's to meet him out in the courtyard. He says all the staff have gone for the day to celebrate their wedding. They are alone in the castle. Mm-hmm. When she leaves, she finds the piano tuner who says, I can comfort you, but I can be of no use, really, in this situation. I can't help you. And the narrator says that she only did what the Marquis knew she would.
At this point, she refers to the blind man as her lover. Mm-hmm. You know, when your life is about to end, no reason not to make those kinds of decisions.
Oh, so yeah. She kisses the piano tuner and is resigned to death. But then she hears hoofbeats. And she looks out the window and she sees her mother on horseback riding to the castle. Mom is going to rescue her. But the narrator, she needs to buy her some time so that she can actually get to the castle before she's killed.
Yeah, it's so dramatic, too. The tide is closing in as she gallops across the narrowing strait to the castle.
The Marquis calls up to her room on the phone and says, look, you need to come down now. And she says, oh, yeah, I'm coming. But then she doesn't. By the third call, she knows, look, I've got to come down now.
Yeah.
Because if I don't, he's going to come up and just kill me here.
It's pretty amusing to have this modern phone thing happening here.
Yeah, you know? It's so
hey,
weird.
I told you to get down here, like her dinner's getting cold.
She walks as slow as she can across the courtyard, and he yells at her not to loiter. He says, you think my appetite will diminish? It will only grow greater. And the narrator then kneels, and she puts her head on the stone. The Marquis lifts his sword above his head. Then there is a loud bang at the gate, and this causes the Marquis to pause, and he sees the piano tuner is over opening the locks of the gate to let this person in. And Marquis is just dumbfounded by what's going on, and he just stands there, jaw dropped. And when the gates open, in comes the narrator's mother.
You never saw such a wild thing as my mother. Her hat seized by the winds and blown out to sea so that her hair was her white mane, her black lisle legs exposed to the thigh, her skirts tucked round her waist, one hand on the reins of the rearing horse while the other clasped my father's service revolver, and behind her, the breakers of the savage, indifferent sea, like the witnesses of a furious justice. And my husband stood stock still, as if she had been Medusa, the sword still raised over his head, as in those clockwork tableaux of Bluebeard that you see in glass cases at fairs. And then it was as though a curious child pushed his centime into the slot and set all in motion. The heavy bearded figure roared out loud, braying with fury, and wielding the honorable sword as if it were a matter of death or glory, charged us, all three. On her 18th birthday, my mother had disposed of a man-eating tiger that had ravaged the villages in the hills north of Hanoi. Now, without a moment's hesitation, she raised my father's gun, took aim, and put a single irreproachable bullet through my husband's head.
Bam! That is what you get. You mess with the baby, you get the mama bear.
I love how astounded he is that things aren't working out.
Yes.
You know, as it says in that Spoon song, he has no fear of the underdog, and that's why he did not survive.
I don't know that Spoon song.
You would if you heard it. It's in every movie trailer in the world.
All right.
I'll play it for you after. We can't play it on the show.
No. Now, after that, we get a bit of a wrap-up. The narrator inherited all of the Marquis' fortune, but she gives most of it away to charity. And the castle is now a school for the blind, and she starts a music school in Paris.
Keeps basically nothing for herself. They live a modest middle-class life, if even that, which is good and honorable, but I guess I'm a monster because I did want her to be living the high life like Stina in that one story that we read.
Yes.
With jewels and
a
cat having shots next to her.
That's what everybody deserves, really.
Mm-hmm.
She comments on the parental telepathy that saved her life. I guess it's just the mother knows.
Her mother said, well, I've never heard you cry before, which is a bit of a surprise. Mm. And whoever cried about bath taps. So pretty strong telepathy that got her to mount up the horse. Well, she rode the train in and then got on the horse and Nobody could stop her.
Nobody. However, her poor mother dies soon after that. And the narrator and the piano tuner, they hook up after her mother passes and he helps her run the music school.
No paint nor powder, no matter how thick or white, can mask that red mark on my forehead. I am glad he cannot see it, not for fear of his revulsion, since I know he sees me clearly with his heart, but because it spares my shame.
And that's the end of The Bloody Chamber. What a great story.
I really enjoyed it. It's really cool. And as much as one might think this is a feminist work, or said to be a feminist work,
it's talked about that way for sure.
Yes, a lot of feminists disagree with Carter. I went to the website York Notes, and they have a lot of feminists that say no. Andrea Dworkin in Pornography, Men Possessing Women in 1981, denounces Carter as a pseudo-feminist. Suzanne Kappeler in The Pornography of Representation in 1986 accuses Carter of attempting a kind of literary rehabilitation of Desaad, the multiple rapist and murderer. Dunker simply dismisses Carter's belief that Desaad's put pornography in the service of women as utter nonsense. And that was in her book, what we talked about last week, that she wrote kind of as a defense of the Marquis de Sade. Nanette Altavers in Gender Matters in The Sadean Women in 1994 argues in Carter's defense that fairy tales perpetuate contempt for women and that Carter's stories explore the current relations between the sexes and challenge the convention that sexual freedom is the preserve of men only. Mm-hmm. So is this feminist? Is this a feminist story? I mean, it doesn't feel particularly empowering to the narrator character. It's like her mom has to come in and rescue her. Is she in charge of maybe her sexuality? But she's not even really in charge of it. She just wants it, and it's being held back from a man. So maybe it's that desire for sex is about the feminist ideal.
It depends on what you mean by, like, from the way that you're saying that, I would take that you mean a feminist story is one in which the women are successful. Or are heroes. And right. I don't agree with that. Right, I think that it's just, and again, this is something that's up for interpretation, but to me, if something's feminist, it brings to the forefront things that women are dealing with. Or it's a realistic internal monologue or look at something that, you know, I might not have access to being in the other gender. So this succeeds in that respect, you know, in that it's taking a realistic look at how she really experiences these folktale events.
Right, right.
But we have to always keep in mind that nothing is inherently feminist. That's a reading you can bring to a work. So you can give something a feminist reading that was written by Ernest Hemingway. You know, you can look at the feminist perspective on something and then decide whether it's pro-women, anti-women, what it gets wrong or what it doesn't, you know, what it gets right. It's a filter you can read the story through. And there's a lot of those filters that we can look at literature with. Even when the writer's intention is to write something feminist, hey, look, you can't say what I get out of it. If I read this and it was just a real rip-roaring adventure, that would be fine too. Mm-hmm. So I think that sometimes, this is just my personal conviction, that there's no difference between a story written by a man or a woman or somebody non-binary. A story is a story, a story. Mm-hmm. And we can look at their biography and bring that to, you know, use that as a filter to judge it. We can figure out, like with H.G. Wells, we were talking about affairs he had and you know, how he saw the world in his other pamphlets and stuff. And we were bringing that reading into an analysis of The Island of Dr. Moreau. Whereas when I read that as a kid, it was just a pulpy yarn.
Right.
And I think all of those things are legitimate. If you are in the esoteric business of talking about feminist literature, then the arguments that you read up there are profound and something that need to be looked at. You know, if somebody is saying this is a feminist work as an example of a feminist work, you might, and Andrea Dworkin probably has a big problem with that. And would direct you towards something else. And obviously there's this thing that happens where if Angela Carter's being, one might think, blasé about the Marquis de Sade, there's other people are saying, hey, this person was a murderer.
Yeah.
And a rapist. You know, how dare you?
Yeah.
I think that she's saying enough times pass that we don't have to have that serious a read of de Sade. And are there things in here? What put pornography in the service of women, right? That's the quote.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can see all of that conversation around it, but I always try to think, you know, we're doing this in the same month as a Conan story. We're going to do a Conan the Barbarian story next, right? So this isn't whereas we had a month recently that was the future is female and some of those things tied the month together. Here it was like, let's see this take on a fairy tale because it's kind of fantastic. And then we're going to go and do another fantasy. And
yeah,
I think it could be taken on its merits that way as well.
Well, I think we should try and look at the next piece as a feminist work.
We should give the Conan story a feminist read, absolutely. Why not? You know, like Angela Carter was saying in our first episode, she was talking about how she didn't think the most female, what we call a female perspective, she thought wasn't found in that many female writers' work.
Sure.
There are things that Conan sometimes does that I think do have a female perspective to them. So,
yeah,
you know what? Let's think about that.
Yeah, I'm all for it. I love doing this stuff. It's so much fun.
Well, I want to once again thank Michelle Sawyer for being on the show.
Yes, Michelle, you are wonderful. Thank you so much for helping us bring the story to life.
And I also want to thank some patrons. We love them. I want to say some of their names. I'm going to start with a friend of ours, Summer Suzuki.
Hey, Summer. I'd like to thank Bugberry.
I'd like to thank Aaron Fish.
Christopher Cassidy, thank you.
James Madden, thank you so much.
Haunter 9, thank you.
Minisode Ed, thank you.
I'd like to thank Jim Morphus Gas.
Patrick Stahl, thank you.
And lastly, I want to thank Clayton M. Scott.
Next week, we're going to be back with Conan. I keep wanting to say Conan O'Brien. What's the name of the story again?
It's the Pool of the Black One.
We're going to be talking about the Pool of the Black One next week. It's a Robert E. Howard Conan story. Should be powerful.
Oh, yeah.
So start training those thews now.
Get them stretched out.
For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.